Hi and welcome. I'm Yaakov Katz, and this is another episode of Jewish People Policy Institute's Inside Analysis and Look at Israel's War Against Hamas and the Ongoing Conflict here in Israel. Today, we're joined by two of our senior fellows at JPPI, Dr. Nurit Cohen, who is also educational director at the Rabin Center in Tel Aviv and a historian, and Shmuel Rosner, who, for lack of a better term, is a jack of all trades and can talk about almost anything I've discovered when it comes to Shmuel. So any question Shmuel has, some answer that he could potentially give for it. But today's topic is a little more serious. One of the big issues that we've kind of touched upon this before, but one of the big issues of the war is obviously what's been happening with the Israelis who have been evacuated from their homes, both in southern Israel along what we call Otef Aza, the Gaza envelope, and what has happened in those communities, obviously the kibbutzim and the moshavim that were attacked on October 7th and the people who had to flee their homes, but also nearly 100,000 Israelis who have had to flee their homes in the north part of Israel. And just this week, for example, I read that in Kibbutz Manara, which is a kibbutz really just sits along the border with Lebanon, half of the homes in the kibbutz have been destroyed, literally destroyed by anti-tank missiles and by Hezbollah attacks. And as we all know, the big story that Israel, or the big issue when it comes to thinking about how do people in the north go back to their homes, is already now people are talking, well, it's not Hezbollah rockets and it's not Hezbollah guerrillas, but it's the Hezbollah anti-tank missiles. And if we could get those maybe to move out of southern Lebanon, people are already starting to analyze exactly what needs to move from the border. To set the tone, though, and to get us off to a start, I spoke this week, or just yesterday, as a matter of fact, with Amir Tibon. Amir, an old friend and reporter at Haaretz. I'm sure, Shmuel, you know him as well. And Amir is a resident of Nachal Oz, was there on October 7th. A crazy story that I recommend all of you search and read about how his father, a former IDF general, Noam Tibon, came to Nachal Oz and eventually rescued his son, his daughter-in-law, Miri, and their children, as well as some other people along the way. But Amir is now evacuated with the rest of his kibbutz. We focused our conversation on that. There's obviously a lot to talk about, but I wanted to get from Amir, who is a well-accomplished storyteller and reporter, his perspective of what it means to be a mifune, or somebody who is obviously evacuated from their home. We'll hear from Amir, and then we will talk to Nurit and Shmuel. So here is Amir Tibon. Amir, it's great to have you with JPPI. Thank you so much for joining us. Your story has really been all over the place. The story of how your father, the general Noam Tibon, came down, helped rescue you and your family, your wife, your kids, and many other people along the way. I'm not going to get into that today because that's been told and it's moving and emotional. But I do, you know, you've been now almost 80 days outside of your home at Nachal Oz, a place that you moved to a few years ago out of ideology. And I know that I think you're up north in a kibbutz, right? Mishmar HaEmek with the rest of the kibbutz. I think one part of this story that a lot of people don't really know, especially outside of Israel, is the story of the mifunim, the people who have been evacuated, the people who are not home. And I'm curious, you know, you if you could explain to us what it's been like, and you're a storyteller, to watch this happen, not just to yourself, but also to the people who are your neighbors and your friends.
Yeah, listen, right now in Israel, we have an unprecedented situation with, I think it's approximately 150,000 people who are internal refugees in their own country, evacuated from their homes. It's people like us from communities on the Gaza border, and we've been evacuated since the night of October 7. We left the kibbutz on a bus around 11 p.m., and that bus arrived early in the morning of October 8 to kibbutz Mishmar HaEmek outside Haifa, kind of, you know, north-central Israel, you know, not close to the border with Lebanon, but still an hour north of Tel Aviv. And this kibbutz has been hosting more than 300 people from kibbutz Nechal Oz, my community, for now 80 days. When people got off the bus at Mishmar HaEmek, every family received a room, very, very small rooms, very, very basic conditions, but every family received a room. with you know, mattresses and clean sheets and towels and blankets and the soap and shampoo, because we had nothing, Yaakov. You have to understand, after all those hours in the safe room, and then the military took over the kibbutz, but still it was dangerous to be outside, so we had to stay in our homes. At some point, what happened to every family is that, you know, a group of soldiers came to their house and said, guys, pack everything you can. You have 5 minutes and we're taking you to the bus. And you had very little time and very little space to, you know, I mean, so people took some clothes and their toothbrushes and just went on the bus. And so Kibbutz Mishmar HaEmek had to take care of everything for us. A few days after we arrived, they opened a kindergarten for our children. And, you know, my two daughters now go to kindergarten in Mishmar HaEmek every morning. And they integrated our children into the local school. Now, Mishmar HaEmek is part of a regional council called the Megiddo Regional Council. And in this regional council, in every kibbutz and every moshav, in every town, you have evacuees from the south and the north. And I can tell you, we have new neighbors now from Kiryat Shmona and Hanita and Metula. These are all communities on the border with Lebanon. And now they are neighbors to us because we've been evacuated from our home. They've been evacuated and we're meeting here in the middle of the country. And it's a very difficult situation. And the last thing I will say about it, for us, the refugees from the south, at least there is a glimmer of hope because we see the military inside Gaza fighting Hamas and reaching some achievements. And there is a hope that at some point, thanks to this military operation, we will be able to go back home. Of course, it will also require other components, a diplomatic solution, a new government in Gaza on the day after. But at least the military operation is the beginning. For the refugees from the north, our new neighbors, they don't even have that. They have no idea how long they're going to be here in these very, very basic conditions. You know, all the families here, you know, people are sleeping in the same room as their kids for 80 days. We don't have a dishwasher. We don't have a washer for the clothes. We don't have, no laundry. Some rooms have a very small refrigerator, like those mini bar refrigerators you have in hotels. Some don't even have that. It's very, very basic conditions for people to live in.
So, Amir, do you have any indication? I mean, you mentioned what's happening. Obviously, we all know about the war, the offensive in Gaza, and the IDF talks about accomplishments, although sometimes it's difficult specifically to see them, and the gap between what the government has stated as its declared goal and how you achieve that, that's a big story in of itself. However, do you have an indication of when you might be going back to Nachal Oz, which a lot of it needs to be rebuilt, if I'm not mistaken, you know, a lot of the kibbutz also?
So first of all, you know, I don't think the entire community will have to move back at once. Some people who don't have young children, you know, and older people, some of them who have lived for many years in the kibbutz, they want to go back whenever it's possible. If the military tells them it's safe to go back tomorrow, they will go. Families with children who started the school year over here, I don't think will move too fast, because for these children, the trauma of October 7th and then the second trauma of leaving their home in the middle of the night and not going back and having to readjust to a new kindergarten or a new school and a new environment, nobody wants to rattle their lives too much. And right now what these children need is a safe and stable reality. And so I think we're going to finish the school year here. My hope and my belief is that we will start the next school year in September back home in Nachal Oz. I believe that is an aim, you know, that we should have in front of us, starting the next school year back home in Kibbutz Nachal Oz. But of course, it will require some changes and some important policy steps that I'm not sure this current government can do. My level of trust in this government, you know, Netanyahu and the Stooges, is below zero.
I mean, you were very, very early on. If I'm, you know, I follow you on Twitter and reading your stories, you lashed out right away. You know, a feeling that you were you not just you personally, but the people of Gaza were let down by Netanyahu's government.
Yaakov, the biggest mistake we did in this war is that we didn't replace Netanyahu in the first week. Because if we had replaced him in the first week, the war effort would have been much more effective. We would have had much quicker and better results. We put a hesitant coward who cannot make decisions, leading the most important military effort this country has seen in decades. And we see the results and all these deals he's doing with Biden now. He's buying time, and in return, he's giving humanitarian aid into Gaza. What it means is that the war gets longer and Hamas has more ability to withstand Israel's operation because it's using the fuel. It's using the fuel and the food and the assistance to take care of its own people first and foremost and to keep the generators opening, running in the tunnels. This should have been a quick offensive, and we should have put a blockade on Gaza while it was going on and really bring them to a breaking point. Netanyahu chose a different strategy. A long war with no blockade. And you know, he basically told Biden, I need time. Biden said, okay, I need to avoid a humanitarian disaster. So they agreed on this mechanism that's been working for more than a month now, time for aid. I don't think that mechanism serves Israel's war purposes. I really don't. And I think the person who is responsible for the disaster of October 7 cannot lead this country to victory on January 7th, okay, which is 2 weeks from now. And I think that's about the time frame that we got from Biden. And also realistically, when we look at the economy and the need to bring reservists back home, I don't think that the man who was responsible for the disaster of October 7 can bring victory by January 7.
What's needed for the evacuees from Nahal Oz and other places that you think this government can provide?
Few things. First of all, I have to say, if it was not for Kibbutz Mishmar HaEmek and for many, many other communities like it in Israel, we would have been homeless right now. The government was in shock on the morning of October 8th, nowhere to be found, irrelevant, unhelpful, and it was private initiatives of citizens like the members of Mishmar HaEmek that saved us. Because when we came to Mishmar HaEmek on the morning of October 8th, they did not wait for any instructions or budgets or help from the Netanyahu government. They know the Netanyahu government is useless. They did everything on their own. They prepared everything for us. You know, the rooms, the beds, the clothes, the diapers for our children. And we saw this, Yaakov, we saw this, the Israeli spirit. We saw it all through the first weeks of the war, right? We saw these initiatives of organizations from the left wing and the right wing and civil society and in all over the country. And the government, we didn't see them. You know, Yaakov, we've been in Mishmar HaEmek 2.5 months. And by the way, when I talk about this, you know, amazing support, I also want to mention the American Jewish community and the diaspora at large. We have had 10 visits of delegations from World Jewry in Mishmar HaEmek since we came here. You know what we haven't had? A single minister in the government come to see us. But 10 delegations of rabbis and Jewish leaders and Jewish students, yeah, we're getting those all the time. So that's just another point to show. Now, what we need, really, if we're talking about going back home, we need answers about what's going to be happening in Gaza. The idea that you say, oh, we can't talk about the day after the war, first we have to crush Hamas, is not serious. I mean, you know, I remember a few years ago reading a biography of de Gaulle that was written by Julian Jackson, a British historian. And there's an amazing description there of a meeting between de Gaulle and Churchill in the early stages of World War II, when, you know, France is still completely in the hands of Nazi Germany, and any hope of liberation of France looks very distant. But these two leaders sit and talk about the day after the war in France, what kind of government there will be, which parties will be allowed to participate in the political process, what the constitution will be, what will happen with the French colonies. And I thought, wow, that's leadership. You're in the midst of this war and you have, you know, fighters, you know, soldiers all over the place. But as a political leader, as a diplomatic leader, you are now planning the long-term vision that these soldiers are fighting for. And every time there's a question, but the day after Netanyahu says, now is not the time to talk about it. So what am I supposed to think? You know, I want to plan going back home, and I want to know who's going to be on the other side. What's going to be the government over there? What are going to be the security arrangements? These are very important questions. And the second thing is economic. You know, we are heading toward a very difficult economic reality after this war. The expenses on security are going to have to go up dramatically. We are going to have, unfortunately, a lot of wounded soldiers who will need, you know, to long-term rehabilitation and support. The communities like mine and the communities in the north will need massive investment in order to fix the damages. And the government, meanwhile, what are they doing? They're spending on all these weird government ministries that they made up. We're a cabinet with 36 ministers. Why? So those things don't make me optimistic when I look at the long-term prospects.
Because politics, sadly, in this government trump everything else. Amir, I want to let you go, but I just one last question for you. You announced last week that you have you're writing a book called you're taking a break, a short furlough of a few months from your journalism at Haaretz, your reporting at Haaretz, and you are going to be writing a book called The Gates of Gaza that tells your story. I have no doubt, and speaking before, you told me, Yaakov, I would have preferred never to have to write this book, but you are writing this book. What can you tell us? What's the book going to tell? What's the story behind it?
So this book will come out in the fall of 2024, published by Little Brown and Company in the United States, and will also come out later in Hebrew. And it tells the story of October 7 in my kibbutz, Nachal Oz, which is the closest community to Gaza, you know, less than a mile from the easternmost neighborhoods of Gaza City. But it doesn't just tell the story of October 7, it also tells the story of how we got there. And the history of Kibbutz Nachal Oz and of the Israeli policy toward Gaza. So what I'm trying to do here is go from the personal to the community-wide story and then to the national story. And Nachal Oz is not just another kibbutz in Israel. It's a symbol. And I can say that's one of the reasons we chose to go and live there. But it's a symbol because it's so close to Gaza and because the history of this kibbutz explains the history of Israel in many ways, and specifically, of course, the history of Israeli policy toward Gaza. You can look back at the 1950s, why this kibbutz was even founded. And the idea at the time was to create a front community directly on the border in order to have civilian life on this border and people who will work the fields and children who will go to school. And later, you know, the Six-Day War when Israel took over Gaza and suddenly the border was not erased completely, but changed dramatically. It became a border that people can come in and out. And you can go through, you know, the first intifada when the people in Gaza for the first time actually begin an uprising against the Israeli occupation. Later, the Oslo years, and when that fell apart, the second intifada, disengagement, and all the way to the Netanyahu years when there was this policy of giving money to Hamas, and allowing Hamas to build its military power and become the terror army that we saw on October 7. So it's going to be a personal story. There's going to be a lot of things that have not been published yet on that specific day, on October 7. Some of them things that, you know, are my story, and some of them stories of neighbors and friends. But then we're also going to look at the history and ask how we got here.
I'm sure you'll mention this in the book, knowing you, but the eloquent speech by Moshe Dayan about at Nachal Oz, a speech that really defined Zionism to a great extent. And that just talks to how important this kibbutz is for Israel. So I look forward to reading this, and I'm sure many other people do. And Amir, you're a fantastic writer and a great storyteller. So I wish you didn't have to write it, but now that you have this opportunity, it'll be an important book. So thank you so much for joining us, Amir. Okay, so that was Amir, and I think he really expressed well the challenges that the evacuees are definitely facing when it comes to how they've been treated by the government and how they haven't. And I mean, you know, obviously he has a lot of criticism and feels that the government is not doing enough or has not done enough and still not doing enough and might never do enough. But that's part of what I want to talk about. So, Nurith, I thought we'd start with you. part of your academic work has been looking at refugees or Jewish refugees, displaced people in the founding of the State of Israel, right? Which is about 60,000 people, I think, at the time, smaller number, but also very significant. At that time, there were just about 600,000 Jews in the country. So you're looking at 10% of the people of Israel, the Jewish population in Israel, that were refugees. Now, with all the heartbreak of 150,000, that's nowhere near 10% of what we are as a people. So obviously still a massive crisis. But when we do look at this, I mean, you know, one of the questions that I think about a lot is, where is the government in all of this, right? Why are they not there? Why are they not doing enough? So I just want to hear your thoughts first.
It's a very good question, and there is no good answer to that question. Where is the government? Why hasn't it shown up yet to the event? After more than 2 months, people are away from their homes and need desperately help in various ways. And when you compare it to the government efforts and successes in 1948, it's embarrassing. The comparison is really embarrassing, and the result is embarrassing to the current government. We have a government of almost 40 ministers, which is really absent from the event of the Jewish refugees or Jewish evacuees, you can name it as you like. And as Amir told us, if it wasn't for the civilian effort and the civilian organizations, those evacuees would be homeless right now. And Nachal Oz is not the only kibbutz which is suffering lack of help from the government. So I think we can expect the Israeli government by now to be able to be more efficient, lose all the battles between egos and ministers and different branches of the government. And everyone should be right now working as a very good machine to help those people.
Well, we should expect that to happen, but unfortunately, it's not the case. And well, you know, there was a radio interview I heard towards the end of last week with Yoav Kish, the education minister. And Yoav Kish was saying, I think it was on Khan, so a channel that you know well. And Yoav Kish was being asked about the education ministry's response to October 7th. And we all, at least I still have some young kids at home. I don't know if the two of you do anymore. But kids were not going to school, right? They were home for the first few weeks. And his thing was, what do you want from us? You know, yeah, we had this challenge, but we can't just in a couple of days figure out what to do with, you know, tens of thousands of kids now, the ones from down south and up north that have to be relocated, right? My kids in Jerusalem were fine. Their school wasn't open. But we needed a few weeks. And I'm thinking to myself, why do you even need a few weeks? What is the whole reason you exist is to deal with these issues, right? And you can't adapt. So, I mean, to Nurit's point, we have this massive government. They should be functioning, but they're not.
To be honest, I think they're doing better now than few weeks ago. You know, initially the government was really unresponsive. It slightly improved with time. It is true that the challenge was unprecedented. It is also true that the government was dysfunctional. But to be honest, this did not start in October 7th. This government was not an efficient government to begin with. It's not one of the most successful governments in Israel's history. It's been a year since the government was established, and the current government is not succeeding in almost anything. So maybe we shouldn't expect it to succeed when a real crisis is occurring. I was not surprised to see this government responding in a way that most Israelis felt was incomprehensive and somewhat distasteful to the events of October 7th. It took them time. They improved, but the problem with the evacuees is not just the problem of the previous weeks. What happened after October 7th? The real problem is going forward from here, and there is a difference. Amir was speaking mostly about the evacuees in the south. Their situation is actually slightly better in the sense that we know what Israel is trying to do in the south. We have some hope or great hope that Israel will succeed in its war effort, and eventually a new arrangement will make Gaza somewhat less hostile or less dangerous to its neighbors. And when the IDF is going to say, okay, it is now safe to go back to your homes, they can go back knowing that the IDF did implement a real plan of change in Gaza, and hopefully that around Gaza, the events of October 7th cannot reoccur. The situation in the north is much more complicated, because what we have in the north is a semi-war, but also a status quo, in the sense that if there is no real full-scale war, Israelis will probably have to go back to their homes with Hezbollah still on the Lebanese border. Maybe Israel will get some diplomatic arrangement, guarantees from France or from the United States or from the UN. Nobody in Israel is really trusts such arrangements after October 7th. So the evacuees from the north will have a huge dilemma as they contemplate their future, and as they think about them having to go back to their homes, knowing full well that terrorists are just, hundreds of meters or half a mile or 2 miles away from them across the border, and that the events of October 7th in the south can pretty much happen again in the north without Israel being able to fully adjust itself to this new situation.
Nurit, when I'm thinking about this war, it's like almost the perfect storm when you think about it, right? If there are three elements that can happen to a country, so obviously you get attacked and you have a battle that's taking place. In this case, they Israel's national defense doctrine was always built around the fact that you want to take the battle to your enemy's territory. On October 7th, they were able to bring it into our territory. We've then pushed it back into Gaza. And that was the first phase of this war, was to reseal the border, re-up defenses, and then go into Gaza. The second was obviously taking the hostages, which not only is a blow to the people who were taken, are still sadly 129 people over 80 days in the Gaza Strip in captivity, but also this blow to morale. But now when you add in the component of the evacuees, it's the fact that we're still not safe inside our country and that people cannot live in their own homes. So it has like a real, I would say, like almost this carries with it a real psychological effect, right? It's not just security. It has social impact.
I wanted to say it earlier. When a minister like Kish says it's unprecedented, and we weren't able to prepare for this kind of event with all its implications, as you said, it's not just military challenges. Well, there is a precedent from our own war of independence. And the situation was much harder then. We weren't a state yet. The first half of the war was happening while the British was still here. The British mandate was still on, and we had no military. We fought battles which were much harder with our back really against the wall. And we managed to overcome those challenges. And when Netanyahu likes to compare himself to Ben-Gurion, he needs to ask himself, well, is that really the situation? I mean, I'm heading a state which has 75 years of sovereignty behind it, and I have this great military force. Ben Gurion did not have any of those achievements working for him, and still he and his ministers managed to give answers, both military and other solutions to the situation. So this is really a shameful situation for the Israeli government to be after 2 months of fighting. And as Shmuel said, we are not surprised, because the government wasn't functioning before October 7th, but we can expect by now for the government to perform much, much better.
I think you're 100% right. And by the way, just the comparison of Netanyahu to Ben-Gurion, right, part of that also stems from, and this might be the fault, actually, the president of JPPI, Yedidia Stern, who suggested earlier on in this war that the name should be changed to Milchemet Bereishit, right, to the Genesis War. And now Netanyahu has also basically, I think that was already in the beginning of October, just a few days, a week and a half into the war, made that suggestion. And now apparently Netanyahu has also started to suggest that, and says also it rings well and it sounds good in English, the War of Genesis or the Genesis War, but taking it back to the independence war, right? It's like the War of Independence is the war of becoming a state. The Genesis War is also, it's this new beginning. You grow out of it. It's trying to give a positive spin on it. Shmuel, if I think about the politics, though, of the evacuees, so when we look at what's happening, and, you know, just now, about an hour ago, 2 hours ago, was a session in the Knesset plenary or plenum where representatives of the hostage families took part in the balcony, and were able to listen to Netanyahu spoke. They have become, I don't want to call them a political movement because that wouldn't be right, but they carry with them a lot of political weight, the representatives and the families of the hostages. I don't know if the same can be said about the people who were evacuated from their homes. I don't feel that they have that same impact on Israeli society as the hostage families do. Do you agree? And if so, why?
Well, first of all, they come from many different backgrounds. People like Amir Tibon come from certain communities and they have their own political tendencies. And people evacuated from certain towns or other moshavim in the area come with different tendencies. There are right-wing people and left-wing people, more traditional and less traditional. The evacuees of the south are not exactly the same people that were evacuated in the north. These are different communities and different people, some of which oppose the government, some of which support the government. So I'm not sure if they can form a coherent political bloc. It is important to note, though, that if and when Israel goes back to a more political type of atmosphere, if we begin to think about the coming election, etc., and we know that the vast majority of Israelis expect election to take place in 2024, they expect the Israeli government to go back to the voters and ask for a new mandate. In such case, the vote of the evacuees can be significant. Kiryat Shmona in the north, that's a Likud stronghold. If the people of Kiryat Shmona are forced to go back to their homes without them feeling secure, this could cost the Likud some seats or some votes. On the other hand, if people who go back to their homes feel secure and feel that Israel actually won the war and achieved its objectives, both in Gaza and in the north, this might add to the leverage or to the prestige of the government, and then it might benefit from it. Right now, though, to see these evacuees as one political bloc, I think is premature. They did not yet form this coherent block. There are great differences between the communities. You can also, if you go and visit the hotels in which evacuees live, you see the differences between communities that were evacuated from certain kibbutzim, who have a much more cohesive type of communal organization, and the people who were evacuated from towns or from cities, who don't have the same communal network. They have to adjust to a new type of situation to which they were not trained. So these are communities who are, there is a great variety in their social tendencies, political tendencies, a way of behaviors, cultures, etc. And that's why we don't see them as one cohesive group.
So I want to thank Dr. Nurit Cohen, Shmuel Rosner, and Amir Tebone for joining us earlier. And we will be back on Thursday. And to some of our viewers and listeners from around the world, happy Christmas and happy holidays to you, and a happy New Year's to everyone who is watching and listening around the world. Thank you very much, and have a good evening.